I welcome you to the Hong Kong Theatre at the LSE this evening. It gives me extreme pleasure to welcome Salil Shetty, who is director of the Millennium Development Campaign at the UN. He joined the UN in October 2003 as the director of the Millennium Campaign. He went to the UN from ActionAid, where he, towards the end, was the international CEO, but an organization which he was a member of for many years and committed to. I knew Salil as a trustee of ActionAid, and before that as a student at the LSE, where he was one of the most distinguished achievers in the MSc in social policy and planning in developing countries in the Department of Social Policy. He has made an exceptional contribution in his working life to programs in Africa, Asia, and across other regions concerned with poverty elimination, work at the grassroots level, and taking much of the NGO movement. He's been a key leader in taking the NGO movement from simply service delivery to advocacy, and to bringing those two agendas together. As an Indian national, Salil earned a distinction here, as I say. He was previously another high-achieving student at the Indian Institute of Management in Ahmedabad, and is going to talk to us tonight about campaigning for the Millennium Development Goals, Where Next in Making Poverty History. Salil is a kind of graduate from development studies courses at the LSE, who makes us very proud, and it gives me really immense pleasure in welcoming you here tonight.
Thanks, Joe. I'm glad we got over those embarrassing bits very quickly. I must say that for all of you, those of you who are students here, I can tell you that they never tell you all these nice things when you're here. You have to leave this place to hear all the nice stuff. Having sat in the Hong Kong theater and heckled many a speaker on many evenings when I was studying here, I speak with some trepidation to, I'm sure, a very distinguished gathering. But thank you very much, Joe and Destin and LSE, for having me here. I always start by saying that if the number of words which have been spoken or written about poverty had any correlation with the impact it has on poverty, we should have eradicated it a long time ago. So much has been written, much has been said. So I'm afraid this won't be a very conventional lecture on poverty. I just wanted to show you some pictures. And if this thing works, you might actually see some of it. Otherwise, you have to just bear with some more words. I'm not an academic. I was pretending to be one briefly for a year here when I was studying, but basically a practitioner. So, and I know that those of you who are kind of spending a long time on policy work might find some of the campaigning stuff a bit, you know, sort of lowbrow, and you have to bear with it, because our sort of premise is that we have had enough policies. It's just that these things never get implemented, and what we need really is some pressure on our political leaders to start making some of these things to happen. So that's the basic assumption on which the campaign is based. So I wanted to really do three things today. One is to give you a bit of a sense as to what's happened in 2005. It's a stock take and assessment, very much from a kind of personal perspective. It's not, I'm not speaking as a kind of UN representative or a campaign representative in any way. It's just my own sense of what's happened. And more importantly, what is the unfinished agenda, what needs to happen, and how we are planning to approach it in the next few years. And some reflections on what happened in 05 in terms of, you know, what worked, what didn't work, and what are the learnings from that for campaigning, in a sense, for the future. So I wanted to start by just giving you a little bit of a sense of what we're talking about, because sometimes we kind of lose perspective. Again, for an LSE audience, none of this is new, but the I find that even for those who've been in this business, who've been talking and thinking about it, just the numbers and the scale of the problem or the challenges we're facing, sometimes we take it for granted. And we forget as we go into, you know, the details of the discussion as to what's the sort of stark nature of the issues we're facing. So you might have heard many times over this year that we're talking about 30,000 kids dying a day. And to put it in perspective, this is like having a tsunami every week, except that it happens bit by bit, you know, child by child. 500,000 mothers, as you know, women are the receiving end of a lot of what we're talking about. And they die for no particular reason. The numbers of people who live without food and adequate nutrition, et cetera, are just staggering. It's almost 1 out of 3 people in the world are dealing with some kind of a deficit of very basic needs. We're not talking about anything fancy, very, very elementary. You know, millions, I mean, about 1 billion people going to bed hungry every night. 120 million children having no access. Now we're talking about primary schools, first few years of schooling, not to talk about the quality of the schools. HIV/AIDS will take 3 million lives this year. And poverty is just mind-blowing in terms of the number of lives it takes every year. It's far in excess of any war, not to say that we should therefore not look at the issue of peace. Now, in fact, it was some of these statistics which were facing world leaders when they met in September 2000 at the UN. And I talked about, you know, these 189 heads of state who gathered there were faced with a very contradictory situation, because on the one hand, you had this extreme forms of deprivation, poverty, facing very large numbers of people in the world. At the same time, you had extreme wealth. The world had never seen this much prosperity before. The 80s and 90s saw enormous wealth, particularly in the rich countries and as far as rich people are concerned. In fact, it's often said that 600 of the richest people in the world have a personal income greater than 600 million people living in the least developed countries. So you had an extremely, you know, volatile situation brewing. So the world leaders who met declared in the Millennium Declaration that this sort of indignity and abuse cannot be sustained. And they talked about freeing their fellow citizens from abject poverty and indignity and committed themselves to these 8 basic goals. Again, for an LSE audience, I don't think I need to say what these goals are, what they're about. The important thing is that the commitment was made at the highest political level. Now, the compact, the Millennium Compact, which we talk about, was unique in the sense that for the first time, one could say there was an explicit recognition of shared responsibility between the rich part of the world and the poorer parts of the world. And the richer country governments or northern governments, their side of the commitment was that they will honor their promises on meeting the 0.7%, which they had committed a long time ago, of course, on debt cancellation and on making trade rules more fair towards poor countries and poor people. And this is really what comes under Goal 8. So when all the northern campaigns, as we go later, you'll find, are basically focused on Goal 8 commitments from rich countries. I've just given the figure that the DAC average in terms of aid volumes now is about 0.25% as of 2004. Now, southern governments or developing country governments, poor country governments, their side of the bargain was that they will integrate the achievement of the goals into their national policies, planning frameworks, budgets, delivery mechanisms, and that they will become more accountable to their citizens in the way that this delivery happens. So that was the essential compact, and I wanted to kind of say that to you. Now, of course, our leaders, every year they go to the UN and they sign all sorts of things, so that's not hot news, really. In fact, by the time they get onto the aircraft, they've forgotten what they've signed. In fact, this time, as part of the campaign, we had these airport actions in a few countries in Africa just to see our leaders off, and then when they come back to receive them and ask them, what did they sign up to this time? So, but I do believe that the Millennium Development Goals and the Declaration is somewhat unique, and I just wanted to say, for those of you who are kind of cynical of all these things, who've seen all these goals come and go and promises and targets and all of that, I wanted to suggest that there are some differences this time around. And of course, it doesn't mean that just because there are differences, they'll be achieved, but I think it's important to remember the differences. First, I think it's really crucial that for those of you who are looking at this issue more deeply, who are kind of policy thinking types, which is obviously everybody in this room, you would find it a great consolation that while the goals are kind of minimalistic and limited in some ways, because they're a shorthand, the 8 simple sets of aspirations for the world. The Declaration is a much more expansive, substantive document. It very clearly locates the goals within a human rights framework. It says very clearly that we're not talking about compromising or diluting. It links the goals to all the previous commitments, international commitments, whether it be Beijing, Cairo, Vienna, whatever, all the different commitments have been made on international conferences. So it's really important. And I mean, apart from everything else, for those of you who have people who follow these things, it's quite an inspiring document. I was told that one of the reasons it was inspiring is because one person actually wrote it rather than a kind of UN process which takes 10 years. So somebody actually wrote it and then not much changed from the first draft. So it's well worth reading. I already mentioned that timing-wise, the time when the goals were agreed, the world cannot at this point say that it doesn't have the resources, whether it's financial resources, human resources, or technical resources. And we can't say it in this day and age that we don't know how to give drinking water, provide drinking water to people, sanitation. We know it. I mean, everybody knows what needs to be done. I find it staggering when we have people rushing around advising. You know, I've been in some meetings in Africa with African governments when somebody's lecturing them on how to do kind of basic health care, primary health care, when the person on the other side of the table who's the kind of permanent secretary for health or something is just kind of waiting for this consultant to finish his spiel, because pretty much all this is known stuff. We don't need new ways of delivering water or sanitation. We know it. The third thing I said was a shared responsibility issue. The fourth, I think, is that for the first time in some ways, we had quite hard targets and indicators and monitoring mechanisms in place as well. One of the key monitoring mechanisms are annual MDG performance reports, and some of you might know that over 100 countries have already produced their annual or sort of biannual monitoring reports. Interestingly, not just poor countries, but also rich countries have produced their own goal 8 performance reports. Now, of course, these are they're not independent reports, but they're government reports, so of course everybody takes that with a pinch of salt, but it's better than nothing. And I think the other distinction is that for the first time in some ways we were focusing on outcomes, not just the inputs. It's not how much money you spend, but what's the end result? What's the outcome of the work we're doing? The process is important, and the declaration says that the process should be based on human rights approaches. So, but it doesn't say how to do it. What it says is each country should define how to approach the issues, because each country is different, rightly so. So there's no prescription on how to do it, but there is an agreement, at least on some basic minimum outcomes. And I think if we look now, even 3 years, 5 years after the goals were signed, and say 3 years after active implementation of the goals have started, we can say without a doubt that the goals have helped rally all the international development community together to coordinate things better. And of course, it's not perfect, but I think it's helped us move slightly further forward. And finally, I wanted to make the point that for those of you who've read the work of Ravi Kanbor or Richard Jolly, et cetera, who've done sort of academic work on does international target setting help, I think there is evidence from the work which UNICEF has done around polio, around immunization, that all said and done, I mean, it's not as if anybody from outside can come, and just because you have the Millennium Development Goals, things are going to change. But overall, at the global level, having a set of a framework, a unifying framework, some benchmark, some peer pressure, some international monitoring and oversight actually helps, sort of net-net. Now, those of you who don't know this guy, he's Lenny Kravitz. My daughter told me who he was. I didn't know who he was. Apparently a very famous rock star. Joe, you and I don't know him. Or maybe you do. Okay. Anyway, I'll show you a couple of clips later on if I can get this thing to work of people who have given a lot of their time this year to the campaign. Lenny's one of them. But the Millennium Campaign, I wanted to just spend a couple of minutes on, not even a minute on this, just to locate where we are within the structure and the system. We were set up as one of the follow-up mechanisms from the UN Millennium Summit in 2000. We actually started going only in 2003, but it was set up in 2000. And the mandate for the campaign essentially is to raise awareness on these issues, to build the political will, and I talked about the question of will earlier, because we do believe that that's really one of the major stumbling blocks as to, and the classic example of this issue of political will is, I think, the whole Iraq issue. I mean, we've seen that, if we want to do something, we can find the resources to do it overnight. I mean, you've seen the amount of money that's been spent initially on the war and then on the debt relief. I mean, the numbers are just mind-blowing. If you look at the total amount of money that's needed for Africa or, for developing countries, and then you put that, stack it up against the numbers we've produced overnight for Iraq or Afghanistan. It definitely tells you that this must be the case. It is a question of whether we want to do it rather than can we do it. So yeah, holding governments accountable, really, that's what the mandate of the campaign is. Now, we have the way we've approached this, and we had to kind of break down this mandate into some concrete ways in which we can approach it. And what we've tried to do is we've strongly felt right from the outset that unless there's grassroots level support for this kind of campaigning for these issues, you cannot sustain it. You can't do it kind of top down. It has to be bottom up. That's the only way it has meaning. It involves people at the ground level, both in poor countries and in rich countries, that it has to have a mass base. At the same time, of course, some of our political leaders listen more to the media than to the people. So we have to also work with the media these days. The pressure coming from media kind of in a top-down way also makes a difference, and it helps to mobilize people as well. So it kind of, all these three pieces are connected. And the third piece is the final kind of push towards legislative change, policy change, the lobbying, the advocacy. And when we say policy change, we're not just, again, talking about, changing a piece of paper. I come from India where, we've got a policy on everything. I mean, there's no area where you can find where we don't have a policy. And some of the policies are, you can't really improve them. So it's not just policy change in terms of getting another document, but in terms of implementation on the ground, actually making a difference to people's lives. So the way we've partnered, we've got five main partnership sort of areas. One is civil society, who obviously have been, I come from that background, civil society organizations have been working on these issues for a long time. We were very clear that we can't parachute in with a campaign. There are people who have been working on this. We just have to connect with them and hopefully kind of synergize that process alongside them. So when I say civil society, we're talking about faith groups, NGOs, trade unions, very small local organizations in different places who've become very active in the process in the last 2 years. We're also working in partnerships with local authorities, municipalities, city corporations, local governments in different places. Youth groups, it's amazing. In fact, youth is, when we talk to older people, the reaction we get to the goals are very different from what we get from younger people because it's about their future. 2015 they see as their future, which is the timeline for the achievement of the goals. And they're less cynical as well. Older people say, oh, we've seen all this, we've tried it, nothing works, etc. Whereas young people have still got hope and they say, yeah, okay, let's give this a shot. Parliamentarians, it's really exciting. In fact, I was with a group of Indian parliamentarians since I was talking about India, and they've just formed an informal group on the Millennium Development Goals inside the Indian Parliament. But we have such groups working in many countries now, some more formal, some informal. And then media, and I'll say more about the media later. Now, on civil society, the first thing that we tried to do was, which we worked in very close partnership with major international NGOs and other actors, churches, trade unions, to help to create the Global Call to Action Against Poverty, which is an independent civil society-led movement on the MDGs and poverty eradication. And this was launched in the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre on January 26th. Just about a year ago, in fact. It feels like it was 10 years ago. And it's just about a year, actually. And this was, we invited President Lula to show his solidarity. And of course, he showed up with his entire cabinet. So we didn't have enough space for them to sit there. But the logic of 2005 was that, first of all, we desperately needed to bring issues of poverty, inequality, human rights back onto the global agenda, which had completely got obsessed with issues of security and war, etc., in the post 9/11 era. Of course, we had these three major days and events. We had all of which had a strong focus on the MDGs, the G8, which happened in Scotland, 1st July-ish, the first, what we're calling the White Band Day. I hope that you're all familiar with the White Band, because I'm assuming I'm speaking slightly to a converted group here. We'll know when we get to the questions. But the White Band is a kind of symbol or icon of the campaign. And then we had the second one, which is the UN Heads of State meeting, which was reviewing MDG performance. And the third was the WTO Hong Kong meeting. And you will hear about this more when I speak, as I speak. The next thing I want to do is just to give you some images from the different campaigns, because that will give you a better flavor than my talking about it. One of our major focus this year was on sort of the countries which are the laggards, and particular focus in 2005 was on goal 8 issues, because we felt that unless the rich countries do what they have committed to do in a kind of front-loaded way, if they don't actually commit themselves on increasing aid volumes, improving the quality of the aid, writing off debt which shouldn't have been incurred in the first place, and to make trade rules much fairer, it's going to be very much more difficult for poor countries to achieve the goals on their own steam. So 2005 was kind of front-loaded on rich countries, and within that, on countries which are the kind of laggards or the ones which are which have the least progressive policies on these issues. So Italy is a prime contender. It's the lowest on the of the league table on aid levels. So Italy was a country where we put a lot of our energy on. And we tied up in Italy with the Peace Roundtable, which is the largest civil society coalition in Italy. And we've had some staggering results there, and I'll talk about it when we come to the question of what have we achieved. But the way in which they approached it was that every year they have a march from Perugia to Assisi, or which is a peace march, and the Italians decided in 2003 and 4 to make the theme of the march the Millennium Development Goals and to link peace and development, and that the march should be the theme of the march being peace and development has to march hand in hand. And they created these eight, what they call gates in Italian, and each representing one of the goals. So it was also a very effective way of communicating this in a very simple way to people. And as you can imagine, in Italy, which is where the media is controlled by a few people, as you know, it's not very easy to get any coverage on these issues. But for 1 week, almost, we had prime time coverage every day on the Millennium Development Goals and all these kinds of things, which the average Italian is not known to be watching normally. The US campaign has also really grown in strength. It's called the One Campaign. And in the US, the one being sort of one voice, one people, but at the same time, 1% of the US budget is a key demand that should go towards fighting global poverty. I don't know if there are any Japanese people here. I can't really translate this. My Japanese is not very good, but effectively, this is one of the actions that they took. Of course, we'll come back to the UK campaign. You're all very familiar with Make Poverty History. This is the India campaign is called Vada Na Todo, Don't Break the Promise. And I'd say that it's not very strong yet, but it's picking up. This is a glimpse from the El Salvador campaign. And here they use the imagery of broken promises. So, you know, the pencil for the broken promise on education, a plate for the broken promise on hunger. And they got, I think a year ago when they had the presidential elections, they brought the top few presidential candidates on television. And the debate really was about how will each of the candidates help El Salvador achieve the Millennium Goals. I must say also that in each of the country campaigns, our focus of the campaigning is very much on excluded groups, indigenous people, women, minorities, or in India, Dalits, the groups who are most likely not to meet the goals. Because we've been very clear from the outset that it's not a question of meeting the goals in an aggregate sense, that these are human rights and every single citizen should be able to have these very basic needs. So this is the El Salvador campaign. This is from Brazil, and in sort of very Brazilian style, much more colorful. And they've created these eight icons for the goals, and they've used it in railway stations, on cash machines, in supermarket bags. In fact, in the carnival last year, the carnival this year is coming up next month. Last year's Rio Carnival had one of the major floats was all about the Millennium Goals, and I don't know what else they've been up to, because one of the wonderful things about this campaign is that nobody tells you what they're doing, so you only come to know by chance. So this is something which I just bumped into at some point. I also wanted to say that the second sort of grouping we're working very actively with are the churches. Kneeling down there is Archbishop Undungane, who some of you might recognize, who's the Archbishop of Cape Town, who took over from Desmond Tutu. And they are very heavily involved in the campaign. MICA Challenge is the Evangelical Church campaign on the MDGs, on the goals. The other major constituency we're working with trade unions, this is the ICFTU campaign on the MDGs. And each of the constituencies are interpreting what these goals mean to their own members, to their own constituency, and how they can join and help the campaign move forward. I referred to youth earlier. We've got all the major youth actors have joined the campaign in one shape or the other. This is the Scout movement. And the local governments, as I said earlier, are for me, certainly, it was a whole new area. I've never really worked with them. Joe, you've done a lot of work with urban authorities at the local level. And we were amazed because in a space of 1 month, they were able to get 1,000 cities across the world to, you know, to make a noise about these issues and to join the campaign in a very active way in different parts of the world. And just moving quickly to the kind of actions which happened around the three wideband days. So this was around the first wideband day, just before the G8, some of you might have seen, we had the wrapping of the St. Paul's Cathedral. And these are just glimpses from different places, from Germany, from Spain, from the Live 8 concerts, from Paris. This is, I think, from Bilbao, the one on the left side. And we had a massive sort of campaign process in so many countries across the world. And these are still just pictures from the various wideband days in different parts of the world, the rallies. I think every conceivable sort of campaigning action happened, e-actions, postcards, you name it, everything was tried. The second wideband day was around the September summit of the UN, and we actually projected the wideband image onto the General Assembly building of the UN as well. This is just a picture from that. But at the same time, around that time, we had concerts and rallies in different parts of the world. There's some here from Ghana, from Delhi, and I think if the video works, you can actually see some live footage on that. The third wideband actions have just completed, which is around the Hong Kong WTO process. And again, I mean, we were very disappointed with the outcomes of the meeting, but from a campaigning perspective, it was quite strong. And I just wanted to say that if you look at what happened in 2005, I mean, Make Body History, which is the one you probably are most directly familiar with, I think, you know, had some spectacular sort of, was a spectacular campaign effort in just a 12-month period. And it was unique because UK presidency, UK was holding the presidency of both G8 and the European Union. So we had 540 organizations with a combined membership of over 15 million who joined hands, I think, for the first time. 8 million widebands in circulation, one out of three people under 25 wearing a wideband. I mean, in sheer kind of marketing terms or communications terms, to get 87% name recognition in 1 year, 9 million actions is just mind-blowing, and for anybody who follows any of these things. And I mean, there's all sorts of other specific things which happened. The EDM, which they got 454 MPs to sign up to. We had 200,000 people in the rally in G8, I think, which is enormous. I mean, outside of an anti-war rally, I think on a development, international development issue, we've never been able to get so many people together. 750,000 people cast a vote on the trade question, trade justice movement, and 500,000 are signed up to the website right now and active. The Prime Minister must have received almost 500,000 emails. I don't know if he read all of them, but he certainly got them. At the global level, I started with the UK because that's where I am, but the global level outside of the UK, we have 84 countries campaigning on these issues involving 31 million people. Again, I mean, I think what we've tried to do is, it's not a very easy way, I mean, counting is not easy, but I think we've tried our best to give conservative numbers, so if anything, it should be more than this. And people also approach it from their own perspective, their own constituency. So the Global Campaign for Education, for example, did its own things, linked it into the overall campaign effort. The US campaign petition is signed by 2 million Americans, which is a kind of record by American standards. Again, Americans don't have the same level of active development constituency. I hope I'm not offending any of the Americans in this room, but I think it'd be fair to say. I mean, just to give you an example, when we did a survey last year in the U.S. about aid, giving aid volumes, one of the things which we discovered that average Americans think that the U.S. government gives 10 to 15% of their annual budget towards international aid. And I mean, they just think it's one of the big ticket items. And I mean, that's the less funny bit. Then if you ask them, do you think that's enough? They say, no, it should be much higher. So that's on the one hand, and then if you look at what the actual numbers are, it's far less than 1% of the annual budget. I'm not even talking about gross national income here. The campaign is, I mean, given that it's such a big country and there's so many people, you might say, how does it help if 2 million Americans sign? But it's quite a big way from where we started. Again, President Bush got 500,000 emails just before the G8. And these numbers which I'm talking about don't include coverage of Live Aid concerts and other such media and broadcast efforts, which were huge in terms of its reach of the people. Now, then I always distinguish between 2005, which we would call a sprint, and then the marathon, which we'll come to later on. So what did we achieve in the 2005 sprint is what I wanted to briefly touch on. I think on the question of accountability and governance in developing countries and what needs to happen in poor countries, who should at the end of the day take primary responsibility for meeting the needs of their own people? I always start with this question first. I think that they have now committed themselves at the UN summit to come up with clear plans to achieve the MDGs and, where possible, exceed them in 2006 with much greater accountability to their citizens. So this is something which is a clear outcome from the 2005 summit on the MDG review. On aid volumes, I think we've had some important steps forward. The European Union has set a new target with a precise date for the first time. That's by 0.56% by 2010 and 0.7% by 2015, which would mean an increase of $20 billion over the next 5 years if they stick to what they've said. On aid quality, we had the Paris meeting where we were able to move things forward a little bit. We would have liked it to move much further forward, but it's a start. And I think that there was also a very interesting recognition last year that harmful donor conditionalities are actually counterproductive, and that has come out in some of the documents which we've seen from 2005. Now, on debt cancellation, again, at least the principle of 100% multilateral debt cancellation was accepted. We had $1 billion in debt write-off for 18 HPIC countries. This happened both at the G8 and then further worked on at the annual bank and IMF meetings, which happened last year. The Nigeria debt deal was important. It kind of opens up possibilities to deal with the debt of middle-income countries. On trade, which was our sort of biggest disappointment, the small things which were announced, export subsidies on agriculture and measures which have similar effect are to be eliminated by 2013 with a slightly speeded up process for cotton, with a lot of caveats, duty-free and quota-free access for LDCs as of 2008, and at least some agreement amongst G8 countries that poor countries can actually decide how they want to do these things. The pace, the sequencing, et cetera, should be left to developing countries and not thrust down their throats. Now, I wanted to just pause here for a minute before, you know, looking at some of the challenges as to, you know, are we happy with what happened in 2005? I would say that, you know, broadly speaking, if we wanted a very short answer in terms of did we get what we want in 2005, I think the very short answer would be no. Now, obviously, that's not a very nice answer because after all this effort, we can't just say no. So, I mean, we would say certainly that in aid volume terms in Europe, we would say yes if you want a more nuanced answer. Not in the US, not in Canada, not in Japan, but in Europe, yes. In aid quality terms, we'd say no. We didn't really have any specific indicators, targets. On debt, yes, a kind of little baby step, good start, but not good enough. And on governance and accountability, we'd say very little happened, a commitment to do more in 2006, but a lot more we would have expected, and we should have had much more specific agreements in 2005. And we would say a very loud no on trade, as you keep hearing me say again and again. Now, what were the challenges in 2005? I think that, you know, I found that certainly in this job that ActionAid, and in retrospect, seemed like a cakewalk, because working in large and diverse civil society coalitions is not the easiest thing. I certainly have kind of grayed and aged a lot more in the last 2 years. It was fun, but really complex work. And the only way I think that we could move forward was to agree on a common set of demands and emphasize the collective identity, etc. But there were very clear fault lines. You know, size, if smaller organizations have a very different view from larger ones. Geographically, there's a kind of north-south tensions, or Latin America wants a different set of demands from, you know, so each country, each region is different, so we have tensions around that. Ideological differences, some, you know, the trade unions might have a particular view, and, you know, the churches have a different view, obviously from the women's movement. You can imagine on some of the issues, it's really hard to get the two of them to sit together in the same room. Then we have very big differences in capacity and the campaigning approach. Certainly the northern international ones are much more savvy on media and short-term achievements and short-term results, and the developing country ones are much more mass-based, or sort of the ones which are more mass-based want a much more long-term approach. So we've had all these tensions and we've had to manage that. The other sort of big issue was how do we, on the one hand, keep the message simple and powerful, but at the same time keep it real and honest. And so the partnerships between those who are kind of much more coming from the communications media or a specialist side, and then the policy people on the other side, and the activists on one side, and the celebrities. And I can tell you, handling these celebrities, I'm planning to write a book in my old age, and which is rapidly approaching. I think also working with very limited resources, because for all of the key actors in the campaign, this is not what they do on a full-time basis. This is a kind of a part-time thing which they do. Most of them are doing other stuff. Their mainline activity is not campaigning full time. So I think that was another big challenge. But having said that, I think, you know, I should also list some of the factors which helped for us to achieve even whatever little we were able to achieve. I think the timing, we kind of were able to ride on the momentum of the public fatigue, which was there with Iraq, with tsunami. There was a massive outpouring, and these three international big events helped provide a particular focus. I think the fact that nobody was trying to claim any credit for the achievements has helped a lot. And the real sort of success can go directly to the public who engage so actively, and it's not any individual organization or any brand or any logo which made the difference. We had no sort of Politburo or central command of any sort. We only had a core set of policy demands and 3 days of action, which were agreed in advance. Wideband was a symbol, and then people were basically doing whatever they had to do, whatever the way it made sense to them in their own context, in their own, it's their own expression that you see. Downside, of course, as I said, nobody knows what's going on, but great, you know, at the end it kind of all makes some kind of sense. There was a significant investment, particularly of human resources, by major campaigning organizations in the UK, obviously, but not just in the UK. But I wanted to credit the UK organizations, because the campaigning capacity which they brought to the international table and to the process was a very, very important part of what happened this year. And we are sometimes shy of giving that credit because nobody wants to, you know, sort of upstage anybody else, but I think we should definitely make the statement. I think we had a real, very strong support from media and advertising agencies, celebrities, and very progressive political leaders. And at this point, I kind of realize that now that I can't see anything on this screen of mine, I'm not sure how I'm going to play that clip for you. I probably can't, so I'll skip it. I'll just go to... I was planning to show you a couple of... Oh, okay, you might be able to help. I wanted to just show you a couple of clips, partly to break the monotony of my talking, but partly also to show you some of the creative stuff which... Oh, great, my book. It's minimized. It's here. Okay, no, don't worry. We'll do it at the end. Let's not... I can show you the clips at the end if it works, but certainly I wanted to show you some of the creative work, which you might have seen some of this stuff which in different places. But I think that the energy which came from some of the really strong creative minds across the world was very, very powerful. And you might have, I have this as a screensaver on my laptop, and I'm not sure, there are some of our friends from Make Body History are here, because, and they probably know which ones are used and which ones have not been used. But certainly this was the stuff which was done by agencies like BBDO, McCann Erickson. The Brazil stuff you saw was done by McCann Erickson. In fact, in Africa, we're getting a lot of support from McCann Erickson. And all of these people are not charging, you know, it's all pro bono work, people who got equally excited about the whole process, and we've been working with them. Having said all this about 2005, I want to just switch to the looking ahead. Now, before doing that, I wanted to just say one thing about, for those of you, again, you know, people are focused on policy and kind of precision and any of the claims we make. I suppose the question that you can ask is, you know, can we say that whatever little we gained in 2005 was because of the campaigning efforts? Now, this is a killer question, because there is no clear answer to this question. Now, I would say that, you know, I also think that in some ways answering that question, you know, claiming credit for what happened, in some ways attribution is difficult in the first place, but claiming credit I think also could be counterproductive in some ways, because decision-making, policy decision-making, for those of you who follow this as a discipline and a theory, would say that it's a very complex process, and it's very hard to find any kind of linear one-to-one answers to this question. But I suppose one could also ask the same question, or could have asked the same question, about the Jubilee debt campaign when it happened in 2000, when we had significant debt reductions. And, you know, can you say that it was because of the Jubilee campaign that we had debt write-offs? And I suppose if you ask a question like that, one would say, you know, maybe yes, maybe not. But on the other hand, we can say, I think, with some degree of confidence that the campaigning work has had an important influence on decision makers. And interestingly, I think, in relation to the G8 and the UN summit processes, certainly the decision makers themselves, in fact, around the G8, some of the Sherpas were very open about this, that, you know, there was, that it had a pretty direct impact in terms of their own thinking, and they were under pressure to make decisions which they might not have been otherwise. Now that's 2005. Now I'm not expecting you to read this in any detail. What's important here is just the colors. That's the good thing about campaigning. You don't have to go deeper than colors. Now, basically this gives you the current state of play on where are we on the MDGs. And the color coding is that if you've got yellows and pinks, does it look like pink or red? I'm a bit colorblind. Pink, okay. So pinks are bad, yellows are not so bad, but still bad, and greens are good. So if you look at it that way in a very simplistic way, and it actually doesn't matter which goal you're looking at, it's kind of neutral to goal. The pattern is pretty much similar. So you have the rows, which are the goals and targets, etc., and the columns, which are the regions. And if you look at the two columns, which is Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, those are the two places where you have most of the world's poor people, and that's where we have the biggest problems. In some of the other regions, they're fine. And if you look at it goal-wise, on goal one, on the first goal, on poverty, generally speaking, the aggregates start looking good, but as you drill deeper, it's not such a good picture. But overall, I think we can say that, you know, we have a long way to go. I mean, we are nowhere close to saying that we are done. So I wanted to very quickly list the agenda for the future, what I'm calling the marathon. We've done the sprint, we're a bit tired, but now we have to get ready for the marathon. Now, the biggest challenges, of course, are on the ground in developing countries, of putting the human rights agenda, poor people's agenda on top of everything else, of supporting governments in developing countries or challenging them in allocating and being accountable for the proper use of resources for achieving the MDGs. When I say resources, I'm not talking just about aid resources, but their own domestic resources. You might be well aware that if you actually stack up the countries where poor people live, the largest number of poor people live in countries which actually are not necessarily dependent on aid. If you look at India, Brazil, Nigeria, some of these countries, China, where most of the world's poor people live, it's not exactly depending on external aid flows. It's a lot more dependent on what they need to do themselves. So when I say resources, I'm referring to the whole mix of resources. At the international level in the north, we have a long way to go. As I said earlier, US, Japan, Canada have yet to make any significant commitments on increasing aid volume. And European commitments need very careful monitoring. They are very good at slipping out of their commitments. Aid quality is, generally speaking, scandalous. G8 countries, but I can list non-G8 countries as well, continue to give their money mostly based on geopolitical interests. Over half the aid is tied, and the DAC Paris commitments have yet to become very specific with clear targets, so we really need to track that closely. We believe that debt sustainability has to be defined in terms of the capacity to meet the Millennium Goals. All unpayable debts must be written off, starting with the LDCs. And G8 commitments, which were made in 2005, need very careful monitoring. On trade, I'm not even sure whether I should take you through each of these, but it's a pretty big agenda because as far as we're concerned, nothing much really happened in Hong Kong. I think the big decision they took was that they should decide very soon. So that was the kind of, so we left Hong Kong saying, great, thanks a lot, But there's a deadline of April 2006 and a lot of jockeying going on right now as to which way it should go. But bottom line is that none of this will happen without very sustained pressure from the citizens, from people themselves, and we strongly believe that external pressure will help up to a point, but to the extent that we are dealing with democratic countries, so-called democracies, then the pressure has to come from citizens. These issues have to become political issues inside the countries, vote-getting issues, and if people feel that heat, then that's when things are going to start changing. So where does that leave us in terms of what's going to happen in campaigning terms? And I wanted to close with this, Joe, that we obviously, from as far as the Millennium Campaign is concerned, we and most of the partners we are working with are planning to basically intensify our efforts from 2006 onwards. Given that we've had such massive public support, we'll be starting from a higher base than before. And most of the campaigns who've been working on trade aid, debt, more accountable governance, they didn't start campaigning in 2005, and they're not going to end campaigning in 2005. So 2005 was a spike, but it'll carry on in 06 and beyond. Now, the global call to action against poverty and all its major constituent organizations, like the ICFQ, the All Africa Conference of Churches, I mean, I can list all of them. And also the national coalitions in Africa, Asia, and the US have all decided to continue to campaign on the MDGs and poverty eradication beyond 2005. The major new constituencies who came into the campaigning fray in 2005, like youth organizations, local authorities, very small local organizations, media partners, have also given a very strong commitment to intensify efforts in 2006 and beyond. African Monitor is a key new initiative which is being spearheaded by Archbishop Ondungane. We are working very closely with them. That will be a big effort from Africa with religious leaders, faith leaders across the faith spectrum. Because I showed you only some pictures of the church leaders, but also the Islamic groups and other faith groups are all going to become very active from 2006. One of the big, in sense, a big difference between 05 and 06 onwards will be that there will be much more of an emphasis on national level policy change and less on global events. Achievement of MDGs at the national level will be a bigger focus. We'll have probably only one global day of mobilization, and 17th October is being actively considered as that day of mobilization, which is the International Poverty Eradication Day anyway, and to be a focus on MDGs. The major milestones in 2007, I'm sorry, I'm going very fast, and if some of you are finding it too fast, please raise your hand or something. It's probably a bit late to ask you this question, but it's probably why everyone's looking completely blank. They have no idea what I said. The slides would have helped. But anyway, so in terms of 2007 milestones, we will have some kind of a Monterey plus five. Those of you who are following the financing for development discussion from Monterey would know what that is. Those of you who don't worry, it's not crucial. The G8 in Germany in 2007. Then we'll have the midway point of the 2000 to 2015 commitments, which is going to be on the symbolic date of 777. So that'll be a kind of an important kind of date milestone. The World Social Forum in Nairobi in 2007. And the G8 in Japan in 2008. These are some of the main sort of milestones, landmark dates. As far as the UK is concerned, again, our friends from the UK campaign and the audience, but my understanding is that there is a very strong commitment for all the major campaigning networks like Trade Justice Movement, the Jubilee Debt Campaign, the UK Aid Network, the Stop AIDS Network to continue with their campaigns in 2006. Obviously, the uniqueness of 2005 with the UK government playing international lead role will not come every year, so the membership of Make Body History is meeting very soon to look at how to make sure that they don't lose the momentum, but without necessarily using the Make Poverty History banner after 2005, which was somewhat time-specific and which made sense in 05. So that discussion is going on right now. But for sure, there's a commitment from the membership of Make Poverty History in the UK to support international campaigning efforts of their own individual partners, but also of the global call to action in 06 and beyond. So we very simply, our sort of whole focus is that, you know, there's absolutely no excuse for us to continue with the current sort of picture I gave you on the MDGs. So the pressure has to continue, and that's the way we are approaching the issues. If I can get somebody to play that clip, it'll be good. I'm not sure if any of our people who know how to make it happen are here. If you can do it, great. Otherwise, we can take questions and we can play the clip later on as well. Thank you very much. And thanks to you for your patience.
So while we're waiting to see if the clip works, you can give some thought to questions you might want to ask Salil. Those of you who are going to have to leave between now and 8, please can you leave now so we don't have a lot of disturbance. And we'll finish, about 10 to 8.
It's in the middle. How do we start from the beginning?
That's from the beginning here. Yes. Yeah.
I should also say while we're waiting. Thank you.
Mama beat it. Much, much, much. To say no to poverty. We are a generation that believe that poverty can be eradicated.
I should just mention, Joe, that Justice Egwuri, who spoke I should have said in the challenges section that particularly in Africa, we've had some of the biggest sort of the costs of this campaign. Justice Egwuri was on the air crash from Lagos to Abuja, and he died. He was actually going to launch some of our communications materials in Lagos and on the plane. Some of you might know the Bellevue air crash which happened. Justice, along with two other colleagues from ActionAid, died on that plane. Our coordinator of the campaign in Ethiopia has been arrested. He's behind bars now for campaigning on the Millennium Goals, which the government of Ethiopia is completely committed to. So,
I think what I'll do is take 2, 3, 4 questions, if that's okay, Salil, and then another round. We've got roving mics, so if you just put up your hands. I'm going to take some from the top so that you don't get neglected. So you could just shout.
Shout. The question is basically surrounding agricultural subsidies. I was wondering, you guys have a date of 2010 for that, which in my opinion seems sort of unrealistic. It's admirable of a goal that is. I was wondering if you guys have been investigating any sort of alternatives to that on the international level of eliminating subsidies.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your explanation. I was wondering that to achieve the MDG, I think the role of the World Bank and IMF is very important because they are the one who kind of shaping the economic and social policies of the developing countries, and it has been proven that they are not having a positive impact on reducing the poverty, and actually it's increasing the income polarization and everything. So I was wondering that, what do you think about this role of the World Bank and IMF in achieving the Millennium Development Goal, and is there any room for, you know, for them to reform their policies, you know, and their activities on the developing countries?
There's a button here. Thank you. You've spoken previously about the connection between human rights and the MDGs, and you've mentioned it here today. And I'm just interested to know, over the past year in the campaign, what successes there have been or challenges in raising the profile of that human rights-based approach to the MDGs. And the gentleman over there.
So, I just wanted to ask really whether, I mean, in the UK, in Make Poverty History, we didn't really use the MDGs as a focus. They weren't sort of, we didn't particularly introduce them to the public. And I'm sort of interested in what you think about that, because some places did and some places didn't. And I'm wondering whether you're concerned that maybe in about the next few years, whether pessimism about the MDGs means that they become very difficult to campaign on in maybe 3 or 4 years' time.
Okay, I'll take another round after Salil's responded to those questions.
I find this question session always very difficult because, in a sense, they're all really interesting things which we should have a debate about. I don't feel like I'm an expert on any of these things to answer, but I'm not sure about, you know, whether we should be looking for an alternative to the elimination of domestic agriculture subsidies. There's been agreement on export subsidies, but domestic subsidies on agriculture in rich countries to be eliminated. Personally, I think they should be eliminated. We shouldn't be looking for an alternative. Can they be eliminated or not? I think it's the same question about the political will. I mean, if we want to do it, we can do it, you know, and if there's so few people who depend on agriculture in rich countries today. So it's really special interests, you know, small lobby groups who are controlling sort of big agricultural business lobbies. A lot of the people who are benefiting from subsidies are very rich people. It has nothing to do with the people who are small farmers. In fact, I think the sort of the 2 or 3 million a year which are earned by several members of the royal family in the UK, I mean, you know, if you start breaking down, if you just do a kind of a name and shame of who are the people who are actually benefiting from agricultural subsidies, most people in Europe are not aware as to who is benefiting from these subsidies. If the average European taxpayer knew that 100 euros of their income every month goes to subsidize some of the richest people in Europe under some pretense of, you know, helping small farmers, I think that would already take care of it. So I'm not sure whether what you mean by alternatives. I think there's alternative thinking being done in terms of how do we then take care of the needs of small farmers, you know, rural landscape issues, etc. And there are people who have done a lot of work on that. But essentially, I think if CAP is removed, there's, you know, if the money which you're going to save from subsidies can more than take care of the small farmers in Europe. So there is no need for a huge new alternative model, unless I misunderstood the question, which I often do, by the way. On the bank IMF issue, I think the bank and IMF, I do believe that the bank and IMF have learned many lessons in the last decade or two. And as I said, one of the odd situations we're in is that if you look at the largest number of, if just sheer numbers of poor people, they're not in the poorest countries. And it's only in the poorest countries that the bank and IMF have a huge influence. It's very difficult for the bank or IMF to really do that much in a place like India or Brazil, or even Nigeria. So it's kind of an odd blessing we're facing that, you know, they don't have that much of leverage in those countries. Now, in theory, they're all completely committed to the MDGs. The bank's statements, their mission statement is now to achieve the MDGs in some ways. That's the kind of super overarching statement. But it goes back to the question of policy space and how much room for maneuver do developing countries have. And I think, you know, there we are certainly saying that the UN system, the international the civil society, etc., should really push hard to make sure that developing countries, as long as they're accountable to their citizens, because that is a whole different issue. You know, when we keep saying that they should have policy space, yes, they should, as long as they're accountable to their own people. I think the UN system, media, etc., should be pushing constantly, and our campaigns are doing a lot of that to make sure that developing countries have the space to make their own decisions. And it's not defined by anybody from outside, even if it's the UN. You know, so it should be them who decide with their own people. Now, having said this, I mean, it's all easier said than done. So it's a struggle. I think it's an ongoing struggle. There's very often it's a capacity issue. You know, very often developing country governments don't have the necessary capacity to negotiate, and sort of pressure is put from different directions. So. But I'm kind of more optimistic. One of the main focus areas in the next phase, I didn't go into the details of what we're going to be working on in developing country campaigns. One heavy focus is to make sure that the PRSPs, particularly in the HIPC countries or other planning instruments which the bank is heavily involved in, have to focus on the MDGs. Because, and I think we're also going to do whistleblowing. If the bank and IMF start pushing governments to take policy decisions which are actually counter to the achievement of the MDGs, then those should be exposed. Because they can't say one thing and do another thing. So it's a combination of all these strategies, I think. I don't want to oversimplify it, but I mean, we have only so much time to talk about these things. So on human rights and MDGs, I think the good thing is that every one of the organizations who are actively involved in the campaign, they're all, you know, working on human rights-based development approaches. So there's not a single event opportunity where we've not talked about the linkages between human rights and MDGs and the development process more generally. I think there's been some really important work done by special rapporteurs like Paul Hunt on health to look at this whole progressive realization of human rights using MDGs as benchmarks. We are also jointly publishing a document with the High Commissioner for Human Rights on MDGs and human rights and the linkages. So I think that we have taken some steps further forward. I mean, a lot more to be done because, and also, you know, in places like India and South Africa where there is public interest litigation possible, where some of these basic MDG-related services are also seen as basic constitutional or legal rights, we're using legal processes to push for these rights to be realized by poor people themselves. I mean, you probably know that the right to information work in India, or you know, on the whole issue of food security and public distribution system, there's a lot of legal, human rights-based legal work which is being done to achieve the same end, which kind of takes me to Simon's question. I mean, I've always said that, you know, using the word MDG is not the important thing. It's the substance of what we're talking about. So as far as I'm concerned, all the campaigns, you know, Make Pot History is focused on Goal 8, Trade Aid Debt. Whether they call it Goal 8 and MDGs or not is not the most important thing. These are important because, and I bring in the MDGs constantly because that's a commitment made by governments. That's the important bit about the MDGs, not the word, you know, not the kind of... I mean, it's at the same time, the awareness level of MDGs has shot up, and I should have mentioned in terms of our achievements for 2005 when we were saying that in policy terms, maybe it's kind of a mixed bag how well we've done. But in terms of increasing public awareness on these issues, I think we've done a huge amount in 2005. And in terms of building a campaigning infrastructure for the next decade, it's just, I think, altered the campaigning landscape, what we've achieved in 2005. And we will see the returns on this investment in so many different ways. Skepticism, I think, you know, we have to keep, because it is a fact that public memory is short. I mean, you know, we ourselves don't remember what was in the newspapers 3 months ago, or television. So it's not a one-off thing. I think we have to keep at it. And hopefully we'll also have success stories, because if you take Bangladesh, for example, when we said that globally the picture is kind of, you know, not as good enough as we like, there are many, many countries which individually on specific goals are doing phenomenally well and are likely to achieve the goals. Bangladesh on many of the health indicators, Mozambique, Ghana on poverty, on food security. So it just proves the point that, you know, Uganda, Thailand on AIDS, Senegal, if you want to do it, it can be done, you know. So we can also show the success stories.
Thank you. Jane. Can you use the mic?
I appreciate the positive tone of the campaign, but I wonder if you have any different kind of strategies for countries where the accountability of the people is very low, and the you know, even though the government may have signed on to the MDGs, they have very little commitment to changing anything that undermines their own grasp on power. And so I wonder, do you have different kinds of strategies for those kinds of contexts?
Thank you. Lady here in the white scarf.
Don't know if you can see me, I'm over here. last term we had the CEO of McKinsey here, and...
We can hear you.
Had asked him if he was aware of Millennium Development Goals, and he kind of brushed that away. So my question has to do with, in your list of major partners, civil society, local authorities, youth, parliamentarians, and media, where do industry and private sector figure? I know that the UN has the Global Fund and GSB, the Global Sustainable Business and Partnerships for Business and things like that. I'm elongating things a little bit, but just a small point also that the United Progressive Alliance in India has come up with the NCMP, which is about creating jobs, 100 days of work at 100 rupees a day kind of thing. And they're going to need a lot of help to be able to implement those kind of policies. Does the Millennium Development Goals campaign address those kind of issues as well?
The gentleman here.
Thank you very much. I just would like to add a bit to the lady who asked about the accountabilities you've got in the developing economies, because these are very corrupt countries, most of them. I've got no shame to say that I'm from one of those countries, and as an accountant, I know very much how resources can be mismanaged. I mean, to give them a clean slate to say, oh, we've wiped up all your debts and you can go to bed now and sleep well, what do you have in place to ensure that from now on they will not be going behind your back or somewhere else to get more debts for maybe their own personal well-being, if you like. And also, with regards to getting, say, campaigns on the ground, are you aware, like you said, one of your campaigners has been arrested in terms of human rights, in terms of the rule of law? How do you intend to balance that? Because it's not going to be like the UK where people can just walk down to Trafalgar Square and make comments about what they think about the government. What do you have in place to get those campaigns in place? Thank you.
Thank you. We've got room for one more. The gentleman at the back there. I'll take you in the next round.
I'd just like to reinforce the question that was asked by the lady over there. You've addressed the two pillars of society, governmental and non-governmental, but neither of those, they're obviously very important, and I don't want to underestimate their importance by any means, but then neither of those sectors of society are wealth-creating parts of society. It's the private sector and industry that is wealth-creating, so I would have assumed in your presentation to hear quite a bit about how you're addressing the private sector and industry, like the other lady said, how you're lobbying there and campaigning there for them to also adopt these goals and to also work for solutions to eradicate poverty.
Okay, Salil, do you want to take that round?
This is such fun. Why don't you answer a few questions?
Just analyze, you do.
Okay, I think, you know, corruption, accountability. I'm just amazed because I spend at least a few days a month in the US these days. And I can tell you that, you know, they are definitely competing for the first place on corruption. It's unbelievable the stuff which happens. I just want to start by saying that, you know, the interesting thing about corruption and lack of accountability is that it's a kind of human global phenomenon. Now, I'm reluctant to say this because it sort of starts sounding as if we're trying to explain away the corruption in Africa or Asia. So I'm not trying to do that, but I don't want to, you know, at all suggest that corruption is something which we have a particular predominant. I mean, I come from one of the champion countries also, so we can discuss how we compare. We had a meeting last week with Transparency International, the chair and the board, to see how we can establish linkages between our work and what they're doing. Now, I think the question really is as to who is holding whom to account. You know, it becomes a really tricky question to deal with. And we felt that you know, at the end of the day, the only way it's going to work is if citizens hold their own governments to account. Now, I know that there are some contexts in which this is just impossible to happen. And, you know, like the classic one which is talked about these days is Zimbabwe. Now, when we had a meeting of all the African campaigners, we had all the, you know, different representatives coming, and the Zimbabweans said they want to have a campaign in Zimbabwe. And we all said, you must be kidding, you know, I mean, what's the point? Because you're not going to be able to do anything then. They said, no, actually, it's completely untrue, because this is one of the issues on which nobody can disagree. I mean, on the question of poverty, I mean, you cannot, the Mugabe government is much more committed in theory to poverty eradication than, or is as committed as anybody else. So we want to use this as the entry point. We want to actually say that, you know, if you are saying that you're committed to all these things, then we want to hold you to account on this. And they cannot actually clamp it down because they are committed to that. That's why we are a bit surprised with the Ethiopian situation, you know, because this actually provides a pretty good umbrella under which a lot of groups who want to organize on other issues are finding expression. I've just come back from Nepal, where we had a massive rally in Durbar Square, 25,000 people. And a lot of it was about democracy issues and human rights issues. And we were constantly saying that, you know, you cannot delink democracy, development, human rights. I mean, these are absolutely linked questions. You can't have one without the other. So the campaigns have found a kind of good way of bringing these questions into the, you know, forefront and not hidden away from in small rooms, etc. So I'm not suggesting, and I must say that, you know, when you say what are you going to do, I mean, there's not much, I don't want to take responsibility for all these issues myself, because it's not going to work like that, you know, I mean, myself or the UN or the Millennium Campaign, it doesn't work like that. People, you know, and this is a complex situation. I think what we're asking is that, and we always say, you know, there are many sort of sides of the struggle, you know, and this provides one side. And the struggle is more complex, and it's, you know, and but we are finding that the campaign provides a space to bring these issues up. Things are not going to change overnight just because we have MDGs. You know, that's not, it's no, there's nobody so naive as to say anything like that. On the, on debt, particularly, you mentioned about debt relief. I'm sure some of you are aware of the work which has been done in Uganda on this, and many countries are following that on tracking, you know, where there's earmarked money on debt relief for achievement of MDGs in social sector. Many of the campaigns are tracking as to what's happening to this money. You know? And I find that a lot more interesting that it's being done that way rather than the bank sending its auditors or IMF. You know, that's, I don't think that's sustainable. On the business and MDGs question, I think the, you know, it's not, I don't think anybody would disagree that they're important stakeholders, etc. But we, it's kind of linked to the human rights question. You know, there's an accountability issue here. And we would strongly believe that primary responsibility for basic needs, services, basic rights lie primarily with the state. It's a government which takes responsibility for meeting these needs. It's great if businesses can help. It's great if everybody else can help. But, you know, let's establish primary accountability here. I'm not sure that, you know, wealth creation is done by business for poor people. I'm not so sure. In fact, most of these countries are agricultural countries. Most of the wealth is created by people themselves, who are small farmers, landless people, through their own labor, through their toil, through wage earnings. That's for most poor countries, the primary wealth comes from people. It might not get accounted in national statistics. I personally feel that a lot of businesses have said a lot of things, but that's not got translated yet into very concrete things. I mean, I'm saying this as I'm traveling to Manila to speak to the 100 top CEOs of the Philippines business community and the Philippines Business for Social Progress. I don't know if some of you are Filipino here. PBSP is a very pioneering outfit working on corporate social responsibility. When I get a chance to speak to CEOs, I always tell them, you know, and I say this to our civil society partners as well, if you're going to basically do what you did before and label them as MDGs, that's not really helpful, because we're not talking about just repackaging and saying that, you know, we believe in all these things. Are they running their businesses differently from the way they used to run it before? You know, once they've committed themselves to the MDGs, are they going to make sure that poor people actually benefit from their businesses, not just the elite? Are they following the practices which they claim to be following? So, you know, there's kind of deeper questions, I think. I'm not suggesting that they're not important. I mean, McCann Erickson is a business, BBDO is a business. They're all working with us, so they're actively involved. We felt that in the first phase of the campaign, we should work primarily with citizens holding governments to account, where businesses are ready to stand up. Because the other thing which I always find is that there are not many. I had a long discussion with the CEO of IKEA a few years ago, and it was not easy. It's not easy for them to stand up and challenge governments. You know, to hold governments to account and take an advocacy position for businesses is not a very easy one to do, because they depend on governments for so many things. You know, they don't want to antagonize anybody, because, you know, they say we are not political. And these are political questions. And just on the CMP question, I think the Vadanathur Abhiyan, I should just use that opportunity to say one thing about the MDGs, because the global goals are fine. You know, we have global goals, but ultimately the goals have to be translated into national goals and national plans. So, for example, Vietnam has translated the MDGs into Vietnam Development Goals. So the government of India, for example, says that the 10th five-year plan is their vehicle through which they'll implement the MDGs inside India. And the Common Minimum Program, which you referred to, is the current national government's political manifesto and commitment to provide employment to the people. So our campaign in India is actually monitoring right now how the CMP is being implemented through the act, which is going to become effective on 26 January, actually.
Okay, I think there's one more question. Three more, and then I'll have to call it a day.
I want to congratulate you on covering so much so quickly, but also to reinforce what you said about how difficult it is to get the message simple and powerful, yet real and honest, because I work for the Jubilee Debt Campaign, and I just don't want you to give this audience the impression that 100% of the debts have been cancelled for 18 countries, because actually it's only the IMF, World Bank, and African Development Fund, which for some of those countries, particularly the Latin American, is actually less than half their debts. And also, I don't want to give the impression that the Nigerian debt has been sorted out. Nigeria has signed an agreement, but it involves Nigeria paying $12 billion over the next 4 months, of which $3 billion is coming to the UK. So that's a very big thing that people should be sending emails and campaigning about, because we want the UK to give back that $3 billion. To put it in context, $3 billion is twice what the UK gives to Africa in a year. So twice what we give in aid to Africa is coming back to the UK from Nigeria. So I just share those as a sort of illustration of, because politicians will often try to say, look, we've got 100% cancellation, and then everybody thinks, oh, debt is sorted, and one has to all the time look at the small print and say, well, it's only 100% of that, and that's only 10% of the total, and so all the time one has to keep questioning.
Thank you. That gentleman, and then back.
Hi, Cyril. Because 0.7% commitments are really now exhausted, especially from European countries, and the increases are going to take place slowly, what do you think is the role for additional innovative sources of finance to bridge the gap to meet the Millennium Development Goals through initiatives like the air ticket levy, global lottery, currency transaction tax?
And last question, the woman in the pink scarf.
Hi. Alette from Africa Insights. I want to come back to the question posed by that lady on business. I think there seems to be some sort of contradiction between what you are saying and what the goals are saying. I think goal 8 refers to job creation for young people, and that, I believe, presupposes involvement of the business community. And the second point is really a question I want to ask you, is in relation to the involvement of Africans in the diaspora. We just published a report looking at the role of African diaspora organizations in helping achieve the Millennium Development Goals. In your campaign strategy, do you have any plans to involve such a constituency, given that Africans in the diaspora actually send more money home than all the G8 countries put together?
Okay. Thank you. I think on the business issue, I think I've said what I need to say, but just one point I wanted to make is, if you take India, I'm saying more about India because I'm most familiar with the country, but if you take the whole IT industry in India, which is being talked about as, you know, the sort of solution to India's problems, et cetera, the entire IT boom has created 1 million jobs in India, with a country of 1 billion people. So we have to put these things in perspective, that, you know, when we say business creates jobs, it creates jobs for a few people. When we're talking about the Employment Generation Program of India, we're talking about creating, you know, 300 million jobs, not 1 million, you know, and that's a totally different order of magnitude. And if there is no direct role of the state in creating these jobs, I completely agree that to sustain it, we need to think beyond the short-term solutions, and businesses will have a role to play. But we shouldn't, you know, at the same time, put it out of perspective a little bit, I think. On diaspora, I think the African Monitor actually has a whole component on involving diaspora. I'm happy to talk to you later on. We'd very much like to engage. It's a very important part of what we're trying to do. Thanks to the Jubilee clarification. I think it's an important point that you made about how these kind of headlines can be completely misleading. On the tax issues, I mean, we've talked about it before. I think everybody would, you know, be very keen on making sure that there are other innovative mechanisms in place as quickly as possible, as long as they're not substituting for the existing commitments on 0.7, et cetera. And I think the work which the campaigns which you're working on are involved in are quite exciting. I mean, President Lula, Lagos, et cetera, working on this with Chirac. The ideas on dealing with the whole tax haven question on CTT, et cetera. And I mean, of course, the only thing is that so far it doesn't look like it's kind of come down to anything very specific. And we don't want people to put off their commitments and keep saying that they're still working on it. You know, we're working on innovative sources of financing because we think that there's a certain sense of emergency and urgency in it. The airport airline tax is a very good starting point, I think, for that. Still small amounts of money, but important. I think I've more or less covered all the issues.
Okay. Salil, thank you very much. I want to just say before you you show your appreciation to Salil that he presents himself as a man of action, which indeed he is, but as you will have gathered tonight, his action is formed by very astute analysis, and what's a great lesson for us at the LSE, where we apply our analysis of development so often to what goes wrong, is to be reminded that things can go right. So Salil, thank you for that, for your inspiration and your great contribution. If I could just say before you leave, Salil's very kindly agreed to give us a copy of his presentation, which will be on the Destin website. And if the people from the UK campaign would like to give me the links, I'm very happy to put those on the website too.